Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Due to the coronavirus pandemic, we are continuing to record this podcast remotely for the safety of our guests and our team. So, on with the show. Very Merry Christmas, hello and welcome to a super special edition of White Wine Question Time. On today's show, as our Christmas gift to you, we are reuniting some of the country's best known school children from the most famous senior school of the 80s. Yes, today's episode is a Grange Hill reunion, bringing together four of the show's best known characters to talk life beyond and then behind the school gates of the fictitious school that was the heartbeat of the BBC's 30-year long-running soap, portraying life in a typical secondary school. The show was created by Phil Redman, who went on to devise Brookside and Hollyoaks with the late Oscar-winning Anthony Minghella on script editor duties. The show was BAFTA award-winning must-see TV for all children of the 80s. It tackled groundbreaking, hard-hitting storylines in a way that no other show at the time did, from racism, drug addiction, bullying, learning difficulties and underage sex to rape, homosexuality and gun crime. But arguably, its finest hour came with Zamo's heroin addiction storyline, which spawned the cast's anti-drug single, Just Say No, which took them into the top 10 and over to the White House, where they performed for Nancy Reagan. It was massive news at the time. Newsround were all over it. But what happened to the cast after school was let out? Well, today we're going to find out. Let's introduce the class of White Wine Question Time. First up, it's Lee MacDonald, the man who made Zamo a household name from 1981 to 1987 with his infamous heroin storyline. Lee left the show intending to become a professional boxer, but at the age of 21, whilst he was in his dad's van, they were hit by a car that was being chased by the police at 90 miles an hour. Lee was thrown 47 feet through the air and suffered severe head injuries, which put paid to his ambitions for a career in boxing. He now runs a locksmith business in Surrey called Mentor Lock and Safe in Wallington. And last year, he appeared for 3 episodes as bus driver Terry in EastEnders. A father to a son and a stepdaughter, he's now 52, and I'm guessing is still recognised pretty much every day as Zamo all these years on. Lee, it's a pleasure to have you.
Happy Christmas to you. It's good to be here. It's good to be here.
How are you? Life treating you well?
Yeah, really well. Yeah, I'm busy with it. I mean, this year's just been the weirdest year ever, hasn't it? It's been bizarre.
Oh, yeah. And I've just seen you recently engaged, Lee. You've popped the question.
I did. Yay! I know, we got engaged on the, I think it was the 21st of March when lockdown was on. We were booked in a hotel and it got cancelled and I had to run round to different places to try and find a venue and no one would accept us. So we went to the hotel. We were going to get married this year, but obviously it all got cancelled.
Oh my God, it's like the tale of Mary and Joseph, but lockdown style.
I was ringing churches and everything, saying, look, can I just borrow your venue? And they were like, nah, not having any of it, not even on the step. So we managed to go to the hotel just for the room. They let us in there, but then obviously the wedding plans, everything's been put on hold now until possibly, hopefully next year, maybe the year after, depending on how we go next year.
Keeping everything, including my eyes, crossed for you. Next up is Linda Magistris. She played Susie McMahon from 1979 to 1981. Susie, you may remember, dated Alan Humphreys and was always stressed because her parents put huge, enormous academic pressure on her. She also liked a little bit of judo. It was on Grange Hill, in fact, that Linda went on to meet the love of her life, director Graham Theakston, who she'd run into some 30 years later and fall in love with whilst working as a QVC presenter. Sadly, after 8 very happy years together, Graham passed away in 2014 with a rare form of cancer, inspiring Linda to set up the Good Grief Trust, a charity that brings all bereavement services together under one umbrella. Now 57, she's the mother of 2 grown-up children, and her work with the Good Grief Trust has become her full-time vocation. Linda, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks. As Lee said, happy Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas.
Happy Christmas. It's been an incredible year. Obviously, it's been incredibly sad for so many hundreds of thousands of people. And that's, as you say, that's what I've sort of dedicated my life since Graham died, really, in 2014. Yeah, so we launched GPT 4 years ago. And we bring all those bereavement services together so that we can offer immediate support to anyone who's been bereaved anywhere in the country. So I'm on a bit of a mission. It was really sad when Graham died and I was like really struggling. I know what other people can really go through. So we need to offer them help and hope very, very quickly. It's a long way from Grange Hill, but it was weird that, you know, I spent all that time with Graham and then suddenly all this has come out of it. So, yeah, I like to think that something good has come out of something quite sad. Yeah, very tragic.
Very tragic, but making a real positive and helping so many. Thank you, Linda. Now, sitting alongside her today, virtually, sadly, is our next guest. It's Mark Baxter, who played Dwayne Orpington from 1980 to 1984. Now, Dwayne, you may remember, had a very violent father, and he was involved in the Gripper racism storyline. But Mark was forced to leave the show, sadly, due to ill health. Suffering with Crohn's disease, he was rushed to hospital, where he spent the next 6 months of his young life. And doctors then went on to discover cancerous cells in his bowel, which were thankfully removed. And he is now, all these years on, still successfully living with cancer. No longer acting, he's turned his hands to many things over the years. He was working with the first ever UK karaoke company. He became a qualified London tour guide and is a black cab driver who now teaches aspiring black cabbies how to pass the knowledge, which, if you don't live in London and understand how difficult that is basically a degree. Mark Baxter, thank you for joining us. How are you, sir?
Merry Christmas, everybody. I'm very good, thank you.
You are teaching one of the hardest courses there is, not just here in the UK, but in the world, the knowledge.
Yeah, it's 26,000 rows. I love it.
7 years of study. It's like becoming a doctor, but with a steering wheel.
Yeah, absolutely.
And our final guest is Alison Bettles, who played Faye Lucas between 1982 and 1987, having found fame a year earlier, starring in the Green Cross Code ad with Bob Carolgees and Spit the Dog. Faye famously had an affair with one of her teachers, Mr. King. It brought about the downfall of the rather hunky math teacher and shattered her dreams of becoming a sports teacher. Alison had studied at the Sylvia Young Stage School from the age of 8, and when she landed the role on Grange Hill, her mum also joined the show as a professional chaperone. After leaving, Alison appeared as a young Ethel Skinner without her little Willie in EastEnders spin-off Civvy Street, which looked back at the early lives of some of the EastEnders senior residents. She gave up performing in the 90s to raise 4 children and has since qualified as a beauty therapist. She's run a recruitment company. She has now got a fruit and veg business with her son Arthur and is studying to become a counsellor and intending to go back to uni next year. Two of her children are acting, one in Doctor Who, the other in EastEnders, and the family have just finished rebuilding their dream home, which meant that they spent six months living in a caravan on site. It's now done, complete with four dogs, seven chickens and a duck. Alison, thank you so much for joining us. What a busy house you've got.
Yes, it's quite a busy house, yeah. We did have five ducks, but the foxes got four of them. And the chickens are just ongoing, really. We do let them free range, but as soon as you free range them, the foxes eat them as well. So, we keep them in a coop now. I'm quite enjoying living the messy life, really.
Ah, you sound like Felicity Kendall's a long-lost daughter. On The Good Life. I could see, by the way, you all greeted each other when we logged on, that you're all still in touch to some degree, aren't you? How is the friendship all these years on? I mean, we're talking 30 years plus, aren't we?
Yeah, over 40 years. I mean, we
40?
Yeah,
oh my God.
That's amazing. We had a big reunion, didn't we, a couple of years ago, because it was our 40th anniversary. So we did a huge reunion because I hadn't seen anyone for ages. I know Lee had probably kept in touch with a few people. There have been a few reunions. I've missed all of them. So, but we all got together for a real biggie. We went back to BBC TV Centre, didn't we? We went back to Elstree, raising money for the Good Grief Trust, actually. But it was amazing to see everyone. I hadn't seen anyone for 40 years.
Really? You haven't seen each other, but obviously there is still some contact and connection.
Yeah, we see each other a little bit, Lee, from time to time on different things, don't we? But and Mark, yeah, actually, on a few things.
I think with us, we did the Just Say No reunion in 2005, didn't we, with Justin Lee Collins. And that was the first time we'd met each other. And I think since then, we sort of swapped numbers and stuff. And obviously, because of social media now, you keep in contact a lot. I messaged Linda today, and only recently my dad passed away.
I'm sorry, Lee.
Which has been, you know, been really, really sad. But again, I didn't know where to reach out to. My mum's been really struggling. And Linda has been amazing. I can't thank Linda enough. So, you know, all these years and we're still helping each other out, which is unbelievable. And I speak to Roland Erkin quite a bit, probably once a week, once a fortnight. So, yeah, we're still in touch. We've got that special bond, you know, me and Alison and that. Obviously, we grew up together. Our teenage years are growing up together. So that's always going to be really special in my heart. And I loved it.
We did ask Erkin to come on the show, but he's recovering from a bout of bad health. So wish him well from us, won't you, Lee?
Yeah, he has been in hospital having bits done, but he's on the road to recovery now.
That's good to hear. We all worry about. I love that you call him Roland as well.
Yeah, I know, Roly. Because people speak to me about him or speak to characters, they just speak to them. Even in my shop, people come in and older guys call me Zam or Zamo, but they've done that for years. And they don't do it as it, like they're taking the mick or anything. They just go, oh, Zam, can you come over and do this for me? I've got two names and I'm just used to it.
I just did it earlier when we were setting up all the technicals on this. I called Alison Faye. I'm sorry about that, Alison.
I'm used to it now, so you just go along with it.
It is something that all these years on, we all still talk about you guys. You are a cultural shorthand. You know, Just Say No. You know, if you ever hear of somebody kind of getting heavily into drugs, you give them, you know, all right, Zamo, calm down. You know, it is like bywords. How is it for you guys? How is it living with almost that legend, if that's not too strong a word?
I mean, 1978, when you think about what the country was like in 1978, right? And you saw this program come along for the very first time that children were allowed to play children. Before then, we had comic rip-offs like the Fen Street Gang, where adults played children. And for the BBC to take the chance on allowing proper teenagers to take the lead, and remembering that all the steps that led to, you know, the chances that they took, you know, going with the bra, let's say, to start with, you sort of go on to the aspect of the racism, you know, with the gripper story. So, you know, so it was the script writers taking the chances to lead up to some of the most, you know, historic storylines ever.
I just, I didn't even realise it was that popular, to be honest. I think because we grew up at the age of 10, just, you know, we were still going to school and doing our own thing and working together. It was just like we were growing up as friends but having a little hobby. So I never, ever realised how popular it was. Didn't particularly watch it, you know. If I was home, I'd watch it. It's only later in life that I think I've started to realise how popular it is. And I've got a young child still. I had a big gap. I've got an 8-year gap between my youngest and my eldest. My eldest is 28 and then my daughter's 15. And she goes to school still and she gets, you know, a lot of people say to her, oh, my God, you look like your mum. And the PE teacher or the drama teacher will go, oh, my God. But to me, like we you know, I'm amazed that people even still recognise us. But you do walk down the streets and people are still shouting out Faye or Zamo, and I'm just amazed that people still know it so well.
Nuts, isn't it? It really has stuck. And I think because it came along and it spoke about the stuff that nobody else tackled, those storylines, as much as they feel every day now, we've got to remember that this was at a time when that stuff wasn't discussed, certainly not amongst children. And it went to so many millions of people because there were four channels. And, you know, and only two of them broadcast children's shows, BBC and ITV. So you had a captive audience to land these really quite important storylines.
Yeah, and it was all real. I mean, I did the bullying one with learning judo and I still can do it now. I can hold somebody's on my shoulder. It's amazing. And I'm like so proud about that. I got taught how to do judo. But, you know, Susie was bullied and this, you know, the character wanted her to do her homework for her and she was like no, I'm gonna fight you. And it was just amazing to and those sort of storylines were just the first time anyone has ever done that. And it, as you said, it gave those kids sort of just permission to say, actually, hang on a minute, yeah, someone's doing that to me, maybe I can stand up for that. And that, I don't think that's ever been done. Well, clearly it hadn't been done before. So yeah, it was groundbreaking. It's so exciting. Yeah, brilliant.
I think it mirrored a lot of really genuinely what was happening in playgrounds all over the country. And yet on telly, everything was far too twee to tackle it until then. But then when you look at the people that you had driving those storylines, especially your big one, Lee, with the heroin addiction, Anthony Minghella, I beg your pardon.
Unbelievable, because they called my mum up for a meeting, Phil Redmond and Anthony, and said, look, we're going to do this storyline. But at that time, my parents had no idea about heroin or anything. So we took it on, yeah, just to do it. And then it wasn't until we started researching and going to drug rehabilitation centres what a big storyline that was going to be. And it was only sort of halfway through that you see the demise of Zamo. And the reason they chose Zamo is they could have picked Gripper and it would have just been, yeah, Gripper's got involved with drugs, you know, same old story. But they chose a nice character to show that anybody can get involved with drugs. And it was more hard-hitting for the audience to see. It would have been so cliche for Gripper to get involved with drugs, but like, yeah, that's obvious. But to use a character that was quite, you know, quite well-loved as a character to downfall over heroin and stuff was amazing. And on the back of that, we got the call to sing Just Say No, which was, you know, unbelievable. And I couldn't sing. I remember getting sent into a room and they said, do the arpeggio to Greek Island. And I started singing. They went, right, you can't sing anymore. Then I can't dance. Sings more of it. And I can't dance. And I do weightlifting in the video. So for me, it was a real flop of the video. But, you know.
I wondered why you were weightlifting in the video.
Honestly, you see, I can't dance. So I'm weightlifting in it. But the charts were different then. We were coming every Monday, and it was only done to raise money for rehabilitation centres, and it was 100 in the charts. We'd come in next Monday, it'd be 47, then 36, and we were like, wow, we're number 5 in the charts on Top of the Pops and doing all that. It was just like, at 16, was mad. And then to go to the White House, went to Yankee Stadium, we sang in there, went to Central Park, see Nancy Reagan. At the time, it wasn't as big as it is now. I look back at it now and even people say to me, you went to the White House to see Nancy Reagan. That is the most maddest thing. And I watch all of these drug things, the Escobar and all of that. And I didn't realise at the time, Nancy Reagan's on that show, on them shows, because it was all the drugs coming in the 80s. They were trying to stop the Just Say No companies all over that. So I'm still part of that, which I'm really proud of. And it was, you know, as much as it was good for us, it was a good campaign and it was very positive. And I still get people saying now because of that, they don't take drugs or they, you know, they've had to think about what they did or why they did it. So, you know, it was a very good impression. And as much as it gets the mick taken out of it, it's still, people remember it. And I get people come up to me say, this, say no, at least once a week, once a fortnight.
Oh, I bet you do. You must have. But you know what, Lee? Yeah. It really did have a massive impact. I can still remember there was a scene where you're in the toilet in a cubicle and you're on the floor and you're all scabby around the mouth. And I, because you're absolutely right, they gave it to you as a character because everybody loved Zammo. He was cheeky, he was silly, but he was harmless. And then suddenly Zammo got lost and into this kind of pit of heroin. It scared the shit out of me. It put me off drugs. It did the job. And yeah, everybody and else around me at the time, you know, it was massively impactful.
And that scene you're talking about, I remember vividly. It's where Erkan, Roland, comes into the toilet. And it was the first time ever Grange Hill never done music on the credits. And it just did a pan in close-up of that character. And I got so much response after that episode because they thought Zammo was going to die. And I think there was talk of Zammo dying initially, the character being killed off. But the audience is so young at that time that had been too hard hitting for, so that to get him coming back. And next series, he went to rehabilitation centres and got better. But yeah, them scenes that I did with Erkan and that are, even now, and there's one where I steal off my mum, there's one where I hit Jackie in the changing room and I lick the drugs off the floor. And them scenes are just, you know, in my head, they're so, so vivid. And they were really well filmed by BBC. They were done brilliantly.
That's right. And then, you know, so Anthony had to ring up your mum and dad to make sure that you were all okay with you tackling this storyline, yeah?
Anthony was in constant contact with my mum all the time and Phil about making sure that it hadn't affected me because it was quite a big storyline to take on. So they were in constant contact with my parents all throughout. But I don't think I never knew, and my parents at the time didn't know what an impact it would have. And what a big storyline it was. But yeah, the BBC were brilliant with keeping me up, you know, making sure everything was okay.
Now, Alison, I know you went to the White House. You managed to, and you did Top of the Pops. Linda, were you part of the cast at that time?
No, I'm a lot older than these two, so okay. So I was like...
Well, I'm looking at you and I'd never know.
Thank you so much.
No, definitely
not. Thank you so much. No, I did all the earlier episodes, like, you know, sort of the original series, and then these guys came in later. So I went into Tucker's Larker afterwards, and then I left and I did my own thing. But yeah, I mean, all those later storylines are just incredible. But what you were saying, Lee, is really clever that Phil, you know, Redmond did, is that they chose characters that wouldn't normally be sort of associated with that storyline, like mine for the bullying. You know, Susie was so meek and mild and goody two-shoes, but she showed by just doing it in the right way, you know, by learning this judo and having Alan teach it. And she did it in the right way, you know, she got her own back and she showed that women can be strong. So it was just really clever script writing, I think. The whole thing was fabulous, yeah.
I love that judo was so important. It's brilliant.
The fact that, you know, we went to the White House was pretty amazing. So if I'm sort of having some banter with the kids, I'll say to them, oh, have you met Nancy? Oh, no, you haven't met Nancy, have you?
No, but I did. Have you played Yankee Stadium? I have.
Yeah, have you sung in the Yankee Stadium?
But just, you know, as the kid sat at home watching all of this unfold on Newsround, right, because literally you were all over Newsround. I think there might even been a Newsround special. Watching you all at the White House, I think you wore an amazing jumper, Alison. I can remember it so vividly. It just felt epic to me.
I know, I had big shoulder pads. They were huge.
Alison, you said that you kind of didn't even realise how big and successful it was, but surely you must have been like the most famous teenagers in Britain at that time.
We were. I mean, like you said, there was only four channels, so there wasn't a lot of choice like there is now. So everybody, I think it was something like 11 million used to watch it. So, yeah, as Lee said, you get the same things. One of the other things that you get and you still get now is you'll be walking along and someone recognises you and they all go, da-da-da-da. And I'm sure they think they're the only people that has ever done it. Yeah, but, you know, it's all the same jokes, and we've had them same jokes for like 40 years now, so you know what's
coming. I'm not going to crack any. I promise not to try.
But I think because we were just young kids growing up, we didn't realise it. It wasn't like it is now, I don't think. You know, you did it and you went home. Now if you're on the telly, if you've been in something for a certain amount of time, you're on everything. You know, I mean, we did do, we did Saturday Swap Shop. We did every Tiz Wars, you name it, we did it. Spit the Dog, we did all of them. But, yeah, I mean, what's that, Roland Rat? I remember doing Roland Rat on GMTV one time, and I was talking to Roland the Rat. And I was, yeah, he was a real rat. I was just chatting to him like he was a person. And then you realise that, I mean, I don't know who this goes out to. Sorry to spoil anything, but he's a captain sitting on someone's head.
I know. I think I did Basil Brush once. That was a fun.
Boom, oh, boom. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, so, yeah, we had some brilliant times, and it's only when you get together like this and you look back at the times you did have, because you just carry on your normal life. You forget it all, but all of a sudden you start chatting about it. It's like, yeah, do you remember that? And do you remember that?
I mean, incredible times, really. You're going out to 11 million people. You're on all the big TV shows. And yet, unlike anything that would be allowed to happen today, you just sort of seeped back into your regular lives. You were able to do that. There was no social media, none of the trappings that come with whatever young actors or stars have to deal with today.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was really tough, which is... I didn't let my kids stay doing it. They Albert did Doctor Who. He done a month's filming. He was about seven, but he looked about five because he was quite little. And he played the empty child. And he went to school one day and he came home and he said to me, "Mum, I've got all these friends." And it was like, and I thought, that's it. You ain't doing it no more. So all of mine have done stuff, but I just don't want them doing
really?
It. Yeah, it was a decision that I made. I just thought, no, we had normal lives. We are normal, but I just felt that I wanted the kids to be totally normal. I can remember thinking, I just want to be a secretary. I just want to go up London. I don't want no one to know who I am. I want to not laugh if I don't want to laugh. But, you know, you'd get people, why are you not laughing today? What's the matter with you? Or, you know, the pressures is immense. And I just thought, I don't want my kids going through that.
Because that's really interesting, because your kids were really in some very big shows. You had one, your son in Doctor Who, and then your other son in EastEnders. But not, I mean, your experiences, how did they compare with today's working child actor?
Yeah, well, I, like we all did, I mean, I fell into this. I didn't even go to a stage school. I was just a normal comprehensive school. So I fell into everything by mistake, got the part, you know, just was totally like a normal girl, just going to a comprehensive school. And I could just see my kids going the same way. So my daughter, she, you know, she really wants to do it. And she did a few commercials when she was younger. And I just thought, this is going to happen to her as well. And I just said, that's it now. You know, I don't want you doing it anymore. So that was it. Just stopped them. They'll probably kill me later. But
you obviously feel very strongly about it though, Alison. And, you know, and obviously you've walked that path. So
yeah, I do. I mean, I don't know if everyone else thinks the same. What do you guys think?
Would you let your kids do what you did?
My two are really techie. My two are computer geeks, which is amazing. So nothing to do with what I've done at all. So I don't know where they get it from. But I know what you mean, Alison. It's really worrying because I think nowadays, I mean, even, you know, for what I do, which is quite high profile as far as the charity goes, and you get, you know, you do get lots and lots of people sort of interacting with you. And you, yeah, it is a concern. And I think if we were around now doing Grange Hill now with the massive reach that it's got, it would be worrying, really would, because I mean social media is open to anything, isn't it, anyone and everything, so it can be really good and it can be really bad. So yeah, I would probably be a bit cautious nowadays. I think back then 40 years ago it was different. It was so innocent. We were just so innocent. We were just growing up, and as you said, it was just a really fun thing to do, and we were just growing up on air, and you know, all these little adventures that I had were just amazing, and I just have fantastic, really positive memories. But I think nowadays, I think it could be completely different. Yeah.
Oh, I know. I hear you. And Mark, how did you find being one of the most famous school children in Britain?
Well, I think that probably at the time we took it for granted. You know, we just sort of thought, But looking back on it, we were the luckiest teenagers of our time. And
you think?
Absolutely. I mean, without doubt. If you look at the path that people that television took after Grange Hill, just children's television alone, it led to shows like Biker Grove, right? So we may not have an Ant and Dec, let's put it, you know, without Grange Hill, of which, to be perfectly honest, because Grange Hill was so huge at the time, we had some candidates. Lee was one of them. If Lee and Lee Sharp would have stayed as a duo who played Jonah in our, you know, in our show, when you look at some of the Saturday morning shows, they would have been absolutely perfect because they had that rapport together. You never know what could have happened for them. But if you look at the years of Grange Hill, you look at the amount of child actors that have gone on to be.
Oh yeah.
Right. But the people like some of us were typecast after that. And the interesting story is obviously that when Lee and Alison moved from BBC Centre to Elstree, it was they got in there just before EastEnders started. And Phil Redmond tells you the story that Julia Smith rang him and said, "What are you doing? You've got our dressing rooms." Because our guys had all got the ground floor dressing rooms. And he was saying, well, you know, first in, you can't do nothing like that. And Wendy Richards wanted Lee's dressing room, apparently. So well done. For do you see what I mean? So it was a lot of kudos around whatever. It was crazy. You know, it was fantastic. And there was some fantastic talent that, because Alison being one of them, you know, that would have gone on probably to do a lot more, but decided not to. And that was purely because we were.
Yeah, what made you decide that, Alison?
I decided that my mum and dad were, you know, old school parents, and I wanted to bring my kids up, like, you know, having a fantastic life like I did. And I just thought, you don't have kids. Well, in my opinion, you know, everyone does their own thing. I just wanted to have my kids and I wanted to be with my kids. I didn't want to, I mean, I've done theatre. I was at the Liverpool Playhouse before I had the kids. And I just thought, that's great when you haven't got kids. But the last thing I wanted to do was go off here, there and everywhere and leave my children. So basically I had the three boys together. So they're 28, 25 and 23. And they were my life. I wanted to take their bikes up to school every day and, you know, take them swimming. And I just wanted to do all of the stuff with the kids. So that really was my decision.
Okay, are you ready for your first question? I kind of want to pick up on the Anthony Minghella input to Grange Hill. And I want you to imagine yourself as him and put your scriptwriter's hat on and tell me how you would rewrite your own personal storyline, giving yourself an opportunity to rewrite or create new paths for what came next after you left Grange Hill.
Excuse me, that is a tough question, isn't it? It's like, okay, but do you know what? I'm gonna sit on the fence and I'm gonna say I wouldn't change anything, to be honest. I think that your path is your path, and we all live our own lives, and we all have our own battles to fight. We all have our highs and our lows. We get things given to us and we also get them taken away. Both Lee and I know that for the last 6 weeks or so, that we both lost really close people to us. And so my path has been my path.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mark.
Yeah, I lost my brother. But I'm not bringing the tone down because it's just one of those things.
Oh, but, I'm sorry.
You know,
it's life and
it's life, absolutely. But as far as, you know, apart from that, I don't think I changed much. I had the greatest privilege as a teenager. I worked with some fantastic talent, all included on the screen, obviously. But those that were, you know, Mark Burdis was another one. We talked about Susan Tully. you know, Peter Moran, Todd Carty, obviously, who goes on, George.
Todd, yeah, yes.
Absolutely, you know, and also some of the other actors that we work with, the grown-ups. You know, we had Robert Hartley, for instance, who was Mr. Keating, who was very old school. Brian Capron, you know, serial killer. You know, we learned such a lot. So I don't think I would change.
Yes, that's right.
I'm sitting on the fence with that one. I think that our path is our path, and I've had a great life.
Well, do you know what? I know that you've had your own struggles with your health, with Crohn's disease and then cancer, Mark. So the fact that you wouldn't change that, that speaks volumes about your character.
Oh, thank you. I use it. And everybody else does the same thing. Lee does the same thing, because I know that he's still involved heavily with the boxing and things like that. But you pass on, you know, you try to help those people that are going through what you actually have experienced before. And you're able to speak from, as I say, experience. And if you can help one person through what you've been through, then you've touched one person, then they will touch another, and it will go on. We need a lot more of that.
Lee, Mark referenced the boxing there, and you were on a very determined path. You were going to be a boxer, and that was that, right?
Yeah. No, I did. I did really, as an amateur, I did really well. I boxed from seven, won junior OBAs, the NABCs, the school's national title, was selected for Olympics at one time, and was going to turn professional when I was 21, and I had a car accident and couldn't box anymore. So I was absolutely gutted. But there was a time when I was doing Grange Hill and studio days at Grange Hill. You cannot miss them. It's the biggest thing. You've done 3 days rehearsals. And I remember I was boxing in Derby in the evening, and my dad said, you can't go into Grange Hill. So I went into Grange Hill, pretended I had the biggest stomach ache you can imagine. My parents come pick me up, drove me up to Derby. This is really naughty. Come back the next day with a black eye in filming. So it wasn't ideal, yeah. The boxing was my main thing. So if we're going to move on to that question, do you want me to answer the question? Because it's a different aspect of it. My life as I am I would keep it as it is. I wouldn't change it. But if I was to grow up as Zamo, my little plan is, so me and Jackie would have left Grange Hill, it's my girlfriend in Grange Hill, would have got married, had a couple of kids, we'd have moved to America, I would have won a world boxing title, then we come back to London, and then we go to EastEnders, and then we both run the Queen Vic. How about that?
How about that? I love that. You could still run the Queen Vic. We can make it happen. Danny Dyer's far too busy.
Yeah, absolutely. I've already had a word with him. I said, you know, I'll be in there soon.
Would you like that? Would you like to go back to a long-running drama?
Yeah, I did. When I went back to EastEnders last year, I loved it. And I would, at the time, I wasn't sure. But going back just felt so natural. And I knew everybody. And I just thought, yeah, this is what I would want to do. And there's talk of people coming back and characters coming back. So never say never to Terry the bus driver coming back. And if he does,
was he a bus driver? I thought he was a cab driver. I got his vocation.
No, he was a bus driver because they got me there and said, right, okay, can you just drive that forward? I said, I can't drive a bus. So they got a guy in to drive the bus. And I was sitting in the seat pretending that I was the bus driver. But, yeah, it was amazing going back to – and when I drove up to Grange Hill, to the Elstree Studios, the security guard said to me, and I thought they were joking, he said, oh, yeah, you can just park around there in the Grange Hill car park. And they still call it the Grange Hill car park at Elstree.
Yeah.
And in the hallway, there's all pictures of us lot when we were kids. And I was like a little kid. I was getting selfies done with myself in a Grange Hill uniform. So for me, it was amazing going back. I was like a kid in a sweet shop. I loved it.
So Lee, you would have gone off, and as your rewritten script would be, you go to Hollywood, you smash it as a boxer, you come back, you run the Queen Vic. This is the life that you would love to have had.
that's the, it's sort of a bit of me, but that's what I think Zamo would have done. He would have just gone off, carried on his boxing, done that, and then run the Queen Vic, a couple of kids there, and smashing it in Albert Square.
But what about you? Were you as Lee McDonald? Would you, is that what you would want for you?
If I'd have wished for anything, it would have been that I obviously didn't have the car accident and could have tried. Not necessarily would have become a world champion, but just that, something that I wish I'd have tried or been able to try and to see where I would have gone. You know, not saying I would have won and made millions, but it was something that I was really passionate about and was good at the time. And to have that taken away is my only regret in life. Otherwise, I wouldn't change anything. I've got a lovely partner. I've got a gorgeous son, stepdaughter. So I'm happy.
I mean, that was, you were so young as well, Lee. 21 years old, and a police chase interrupted the dream that you had for the rest of your life.
It was a nightmare. I was coming across a set of red lights green lights, and the police were chasing a Peugeot 205. And it hit the car at 90 mile an hour, and the van span. Lucky I had no one in the van. And lucky I didn't have a seatbelt on, because the vehicle spanned several times. But I went through the windscreen, but the steering wheel got crushed through the driver's seat. So if I had had a seatbelt at that time, I didn't have to wear them, then I would be dead anyway. It would have been a goodnight scenario. But fortunately, I come out of it, but obviously with the head injuries, they said you can't box anymore. And it was only months before that I was about to sign a contract with a promoter for quite good money, because I could put bums on seats.
I'm
gutted after that.
Gutted for you, just listening. Linda, if you had the ability to turn Anthony Minghella for a moment and rewrite what happened next for you, I'm guessing that Graham would still feature very heavily in your life, and that's something you would have changed in a heartbeat.
Of course I'd change. I'd change, you know, the fact that he got cancer is just too sad, because he was at the pinnacle of his career and he had so much more to give. But it is weird how, as Mark said, you know, your path, I think, is your path now. I never used to be a fatalist, but I think my path is my path. Like Lee and like Alison and Mark, you know, I've got the most beautiful children, and that is the my whole life. And I'm so, so blessed to have my children. And I've been really lucky in life, the way that, you know, my work's gone and I've sort of put together project after project. I'm a bit of a crazy entrepreneur and I love projects. And I would wish that my dad was here longer. You know, my dad died 20 years ago, and that I really would want my dad to be here to see his grandchildren, to see what I was doing, and to be there for my mum. But all in all, it's really weird, because when Graham died, my whole life changed. And I know, I get a bit emotional now. I know that, you know, since the Good Grief Trust has been founded, we have, like, Mark is our ambassador, Todd's one of our ambassadors. There has been so much good done in the past 4 years. And I'm so proud of everybody here that I've been working with to change, you know, and improve the lives of people who have been bereaved. And it's just the most crazy journey, to be honest, Kate. And it's just thousands and thousands of people. And it's just amazing. And everyone's on board now, and we're trying to change it. And COVID's changed everything, everyone's life this year. And it's so important that we help people who have had a bereavement. And I just think it's just meant to be. And I'm just so grateful. Every day I wake up and I'm so, so grateful for every minute that I've got here. And I just, I wouldn't change anything in that way. But obviously the people who have died, I would want them to have longer, healthier lives. It's just so sad, so sad. But I'm just so grateful. I'm just overwhelmed with gratitude, to be honest. Just, yeah, really, really lucky.
And when we talk about rewriting the past, maybe would you have changed the timeline so that you didn't have to wait 30 years to run into Graham again?
Well, do you know what? It's weird, no, because then I have my children, you know. So if I hadn't had my children, you know, earlier on, then maybe something else wouldn't have happened. But yes, of course, it would have been amazing to meet him earlier and have a relationship. But I had the most amazing relationship with my husband. I've got two amazing children with that. So it's just crazy. We had 8 really strong years and very, very happy. But yeah, it's a weird old world. But I just know that there is sort of a reason, there's a purpose, and I'm just doing what I have to feel as though I'm meant to do, really. But as I say, every morning I wake up probably, you know, like us all with children, I think it's the most important thing in the world. And that's just my whole life.
And Alison, I mean, you spoke about the fact that you seem quite convinced by your decision at the time and subsequently that giving up acting, focusing on your family, that was the right course for you. Is there anything that you would have rewritten about what came next after Grange Hill?
No, I don't think so. Not really. I mean, as Linda said, I'm an orphan, so I would love my mum and dad to still be here. I was desperate for a daughter from all the very first pregnancy, and I had three boys all in a go, or in a row, should I say. I didn't have them all together. And then I was desperate for a little girl, and I wanted to show my mum that I had a little girl, and then she died before I had my daughter. But then I fell pregnant straight away after, and then I got my daughter, you know, after my mum died. So I believe that my mum sent my daughter. I don't think I would change anything, but I am getting to the stage now where I think it's my time now, because all the kids are old enough. So hence I've gone into counselling. I have had a really, really blessed life. I've seen a lot of troubled people in my life as I've grown up. I suffered postnatal depression with two of the kids, certainly. And just things that happen, you know, come along my way. On Christmas Day, like 15 years ago, there was a guy that was going to jump off a bridge, and I stopped the car and I got out and I spoke to him and talked him down, sort of. And, you know, I got my son, who was only about 6 at the time, and I was just like, ring 999, tell him there's a jumper, you know. And so I, you know, the fact that just so many people, like drug addicts and different things along the way, and I just think that's my calling. I've had a really blessed life, and now I want to give something back. And I've got so much empathy. I am a real empathic person, and I just want to help people. And hence that I've, you know, recently got involved in volunteering for a charity called Reach Out for Mental Health. So again, yeah, you know, there's so many people out there that are desperate to speak to somebody and they can't, or they don't know how to, or they, you know, they haven't got anyone in their lives that they can speak to. So this charity, Reach Out for Mental Health, you can speak to somebody, and you get an hour per week for 12 weeks. It can go on if need be. And then you're like a befriender to somebody, and they can tell you exactly whatever they need to tell you. You know, it can be bereavement or stuff along the way that's gone on in their lives. And, you know, if I can be there to help people and give something back, that makes me happy.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Sticking with the mental health theme, I wondered if we could touch upon the challenges that come with transitioning to what is considered to be a regular life with regular jobs after being so well known as teenagers. Because if we you left in the kind of late 80s, if you cast ahead to the 90s and look at what happened to the likes of the Mickey Mouse Club and all those other child stars that came out of Hollywood, so many of them ended up with mental health issues, drink and drug addictions. And I just wanted to know how you'd managed that transition without it costing you dearly.
I think it's going back to what we were talking about before, that we didn't have that sort of awe from people because there was not, it sort of finished really, like Alison was saying, you know, there was no social media, you know, we didn't have the continued sort of focus and spotlight. I know for me, it was my family because my dad and my mom are really grounded and you know, we're really grounded family and I was just a worker and just went on to work. You sort of forgot about it really. And I think if there'd been that continued sort of adoration or sort of that massive spotlight like you got from those American stars, maybe it might have been different. But I think here we do it a bit differently than the States. I think for me, I just went back to work and I just, you know, just went back to my day job, if you like. So I was still acting. I'm still acting until I was probably early 30s. I went and did loads of theatre, musical theatre, because I trained at Italia Conti. So I was singing and dancing and everything. And then I went into business. I got married in, when I was 29, and I realised there was actually a bit of a gap to be a wedding planner. So I was a wedding planner for 12 years. But I was driven by business, really. And I just wanted to, like, you know, again, put a party on and do projects. And I was just sort of driven by this whole exciting thing that was happening with my life. It was like, oh, let's just think of another thing to do. And I did loads of stuff. I did loads of stuff. But yeah, that to me was my lifeline. I just thought, no, you know, I don't think I'd ever get that sort of sidelined or sort of big-headed or in that. Yeah, I don't think that. My mum and dad would never allow me anyway, even if I was that character. I'm just not that character, really. I just got to sort of get on with stuff, really, I think. I remember doing a program, I think it was with Esther Ranson, and it was all about, you know, where are they now? And I remember sort of saying, I think, I can't remember, it was Tina Charles, I think, was on with me. And they were saying about child actors and being sort of quite well known when you're young. You know, you either sort of crumble and it can really get to you, or you just excel because actually you've had a really strong grounding and I'm sure we all agree, like, it was hard work. You know, Grangehill was actually quite hard work and it was brilliant training ground and you had to be quite self-disciplined. And I thought, actually, you know, I've done what I was, I don't know, I felt quite sort of good when I came out of it because I had this massive training ground that sort of made me feel a bit more level-headed and grounded with life, I think, really. Yeah. That's my character anyway, I suppose. You just sort of have to go with the person that you are.
And was that the same for the rest of you guys?
I mean, yeah, it was. I remember the day that I finished Grangehill, it was quite a big thing because you knew it was all going to end really, really quickly. But the good thing for me at that time, I think I finished when I was 17, 18, I was boxing. So I'd gone from there to the boxing. So that was all going to be left behind anyway, the acting. So it didn't bother me. When it was a bit of a struggle for me was when I was 21 and the boxing finished. And then I thought, do I want to get back into the acting? And I did and I didn't. So I did bits. We all did The Bill and stuff like that. But it wasn't as regular as what I was used to. And I was thinking, okay, I've had a break now and the boxing's not worked out. So acting's the next best thing. But it wasn't like a regular job. That's why I had to go and work for a locksmith, because I would get a couple of weeks here, a couple of weeks there, and that was soul destroying. And I remember working in a warehouse at the time, and I was putting keys in a bag, counting keys, and it was announced on the radio that John Alford had gone into to London's burning, and I was mortified. I was like, I was this person who was trying to get TV work and struggling doing a warehouse job, and John had got this big job, you know, best of luck to him, but it really hurt. I was like, you know, that's tough. And then I did this thing with Nick Berry, which was a one-off called Respect, and I thought, that's it, you get this job. It was a good job over a month, and I thought, I'm back in now. And then after that, I was back putting keys in so it can be soul destroying. It's really difficult to do, and then I just give everything up and then got the locksmith, and now I'm doing stuff now, like EastEnders are doing a film at the moment with Peter Goddard. And because I'm not relying on it and I'm not wanting, I mean, I want it as much, but I'm not in need of it as much. It's nice when it comes. So for me, mentally now, it's really nice to get time to go back into it. But I think for most of us, unless we give up completely at 17, said we don't want to act anymore, we're moving on. But I think a lot of us still had agents and wanted to do stuff. And from being in a program that you was in work every day to then getting a in the bill or an advert here or something like that was soul destroying for all of us. And people used to come up to me and go, why are you not in EastEnders now? Or why are you not working? Or why people expected us to go on to something else. And I think that was the late 20s was when it really affected me. And it did hurt that it never worked out properly. But it's gone reversal now. And now I'm doing stuff like EastEnders and doing films and stuff. So I'm enjoying it now. But it was tough. There was a tough period, definitely for me. And I'm sure for a few of the others as well.
You know, for me, it was sort of, and Lee's hit on it already, that we were the luckiest teenagers, but probably the unluckiest 20-somethings. Because, you know, the greatest will in the world, you know, your agents at the time were saying, look, there's not many good parts for people of your age. So, we're gonna hold off. We're not going to send you for this because, you know, you've got a profile that's up there and you just want to work, you know. And so sometimes it gets dictated to you that you've got all this experience at such a young age and yet nobody wants to trust you with it, you know. And so for me personally, I left really suddenly under a cloud because obviously I was for 2 years prior to me go, you know, prior to Series 7, I was secretly suffering with Crohn's disease, which was a stress-related disease. And of course, we were the most stressed teenagers in the country because most people think it was a fantastic life, but we were living it. And Lee will all tell you that walking down the street could become a joy, but it could also turn into something that was very sinister. You had to be on your guard the whole time. So again, you know, I was lucky enough.
In what way sinister, Mark?
Because we were teenagers, right? We were school kids. And you're a mentality at that age where other school kids see you as a threat or they are jealous of what has happened to you, okay? You know, we're the really lucky ones. We're the ones that picked, you know, and they think, oh, you're on. So the boys always try to pick a fight. And the girls that were with their boyfriends try to pick you up, which meant the boyfriends then wanted to pick a fight. And so you're then running through Kentucky Fried Chicken at the back door, trying to get away from everybody. But no, and quite right, exactly the same as Lee, you find your opportunities are sort of sliced in half, you know, completely taken away at some stage. I had a fight of a different kind on my hand, but, you know, for someone like Lee, Alison decided to take herself out of it, but I think that they could have gone on and done a lot more if they were given more of a chance, really.
This was before, I mean, you tell me if I've got this right or wrong, but before the hours were set as they are now for child actors. So you would work longer than a 12, 13-year-old actor on today's sets.
Yes. And with all the best will in the world, even though legally we were supposed to do X amount of hours here and so on and so forth, that never happened. I mean, we were supposed to be in being tutored, and we were driving a motorised wheelchair around the donut of the BBC on the in the basement. That's what we were doing for education, right? That was it. That was it. Well, you know, and to be fair, we were also living the dream. So we were all going to go on and be famous.
Yeah.
So we didn't need education. What was that for?
And also, I think, you know, you referenced the fact that, you know, you guys were flat out busy, right? And you're child actors. You're not supposed to be working, and yet you are. And Lee, you said it, you were working every day. It's almost like a false start to the realities of an actor's life, which is that 95% of actors don't work. And you almost had this kind of Narnia-esque experience straight off the bat going, well, where's it all gone, you know?
That's the trouble, because I started when I was young. I did a series with Mike Reed. He played my dad for a program called Noah's Castle when I was really young. And I'd worked quite a bit up until Grange Hill. And then Grange Hill, you, as an actor, you think that's how it's going to be. At that age, I just thought I didn't want to do it. But at 21, when I wanted to go back to it, I just assumed that I would just go from job to job and be working constantly. And it isn't like that. And it is soul destroying. And I would walk into auditions and they'd be like, Zamo. And they've already got a picture in their head of the character they want, and they don't want that character that you are. So you would be typecast. And I think I stayed in it quite long. So by the time I left at 17, 18, I was already an adult. If you left, because I was I was told to leave a couple of years early if I wanted to be an actor, so that the change would be between 14 and 18, you're going to change. And I got the storyline for the drugs, and I wanted to take that, and I stayed on. But that was probably not a good idea in the fact that all of my early 20s, I got typecast as Zamo. It was just Zamo walking into a room before I'd even walked into the audition. The working constantly and the typecasting was two really negatives for me in my mid-20s to carry on. Because I still look like Zamo sort of now, but then I really look like Zamo even at sort of 21, 22. So it was just a bit of a nightmare, and it was soul destroying for a little period of time.
I think that's why I decided to go into business, because I didn't want to sit and wait for the phone to ring and not get good stuff. And that's the problem, as you say, if you've worked really in exciting programs and you've done really well, and then suddenly it all starts drying up, it is soul destroying. It really is. So I just thought, I'm going to try and do something else. That's where I went. But then I went back into it. I was, presenting on QVC and stuff, which is great. And as Mark said, it's like your training ground, and you can use it for anything, for any sort of aspect of life, and just use what you got. And I know I got a lot from Grange Hill from that. Yeah.
I think as Lee said, if I could have a pound for every person that said to me, "Oh, you should be in EastEnders," I'd be rich. Because that's kind of what you did as well. I mean, I did London's Burning, I done The Bill, I did obviously played Ethel. But the amount of people that still say now, "Oh, you'll be perfect for EastEnders, behind the bar or whatever," and I'm I'm in a better place now, that I can really do whatever I want because the kids are sorted. But as regards to, keeping your feet on the ground and mental health, I think, you just have to be honest with yourself. And I do believe your life is, to a certain extent, mapped out. You get these turnings in life. You go right or you go left. And, you take your pick. And I'm a really positive person. And I really believe if you're positive about anything, you can do it. For instance, Arthur, my son, was in IT for years. 5 years he left school and went straight into IT, and he kept coming home and he was really upset. "Mum, I really don't like this. I'm really bored. I don't want to be messing about at the computer for years." And I was like, "Arthur, it's a really good job. Like, wow, you're really good on computers. It's a great career." And he was like, no. And I got speaking to Julianne, actually, who I was still very, very close with. She played Diane Cooney in Grange Hill. And her dad was a greengrocer supplying to the fruit and veg throughout the industry of, wholesale. And I said to Arthur, "I think that'd be good, Arthur. Why don't you give that a go?" And he was like, "Yeah, all right. Yeah, I might." And then I got speaking to Julianne's dad, and we had a few meetings, and he trained Arthur up, basically. I mean, Peter Steele is a legend. What an amazing man. He's been in the industry for so many years. And he trained Arthur up for 6 months. We backed Arthur, we bought him his van and off he went. And he couldn't do it one day, and he said, "Oh, I can't get up there tonight, Mum. Can you go up there for me?" So me and Dean, my husband, we will just do anything, you just got to do it, haven't you? So we went up there with the trolley, and we had our first order, and it was a box of mushrooms and a box of tomatoes. And that was all that was on our trolley. And I was pulling the trolley, and Dean was like, "I can't believe we're doing this." And Dean was really embarrassed about it. And I was like, "What? It's fine." And I actually loved it. So you go out the market at like 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning, and why everyone's asleep, the whole world's coming to life. And the buzz is amazing. You're going and I always check the fruit and veg really well. I'm giving it a squeeze, make sure the peaches are good, and turning it all around. But it was taking me too long. And then Arthur goes up there and he's like, he has a little look and he does it so quickly. I just believe that, you take the paths, you go right, you go left, you just have a go at everything, and what will be will be. But positivity makes things happen, I think.
I think it's fair to say that 2020 has been a year that no one could have predicted. So can you think of a moment or a time in your life when you could never have predicted what was about to unfold?
I just think COVID, I mean, this has got to be, who could have, you couldn't make this up. It's like a sci-fi movie or something. How on earth? I mean, it's so surreal. People are walking around in masks and I look at them and I think, oh my God, are we really all walking around in masks now? I just, you know, and I go back to saying to the kids, you know, if you can, my eldest has got his house and I'm going to be a nan, by the way, in 3 weeks.
No, Nanny Alison,
yes, granddad thing, yeah.
No way! Yeah,
my eldest son, we don't know what it is, so I cannot wait. We're hoping it's here before Christmas.
Congratulations,
thank
lovely.
You. Can't wait. But, you know, the fact that he can't go to the scans for his baby, which is just as important for the dad to go as the mum to go. I mean, I am devastated for him that he's missed out on all of those amazing scans. Yet you can go to work and you can eat in restaurants. You can sit on the train, but a father can't go and watch his newborn baby on the screen. So I don't think there's ever going to be, I mean, I hope so, because this is bad. I don't think there's going to be ever a worse time in my life or our lives than what's happening. You know, this is the weirdest thing ever.
Lee, Mark, any times in your lives that you could never have predicted what was about to come?
Mine would be this year, probably, just before COVID hit. I mean, there's a jeweller in Covent Garden, so I had all these plans to get married later in the year. So I'd been sorting all this out, and then the ring was being made up, and I got a call on Friday was the 20th of March, on the 19th, saying, you better come down because we might close to get the ring. So we was all booked in on Saturday the 21st to propose. And the lockdown happened that weekend. So for me, my business was in a worry in the fact I had to close my business. And it was all of a sudden as well. A couple of weeks before that, all the plans were going ahead. There was talk of a virus, but it was that. I remember that weekend, I remember ringing around people going, I'm really in trouble. My business is going to close. I've got to pay mortgages. I don't know where I go from here. So them couple of weeks were the worst couple of weeks ever. We were fortunately allowed to stay open and we have ticked over, but the wedding got cancelled. Obviously that's going to be put off till next year. So for me, that week when I had no idea this was going to happen, it happened within the space of a couple of days. Because I remember we had our plan to go. It was Jesse's birthday on the 22nd, so he was going 21st. The week before, big shutdown. It was the biggest thing to hit me, and fortunately I've come through it, and I really, really feel for the companies and the sole traders and the shops that have had to close, because it's been a desperate time for them. But for me, that week up to the lockdown was a nightmare, and the whole year's been a nightmare. For me, I'm okay and I've got through it. I just feel for everybody that has had to shut businesses, shops, and you know, and have gone to the wall. I really, really feel for them people. But hopefully the new year, you know, with the vaccines and stuff, it's all positive. But so many people have lost so much. Touch wood, you know, I've got through it, fortunately, with family and friends and stuff. So fingers crossed for the future.
You're so right. You know, it's a year that we have literally been living on our wits, hanging on by the skin of our teeth. And for so many brilliant men and women who work incredibly hard, they've lost livelihoods through no fault of their own. Yeah. Just circumstance, situation. And then, of course, on a far more meaningful level, those that have lost loved ones to this virus. So please, God, get this vaccine rolled out, please. Amen to that. And Mark?
I'm going to go different. I'm going to you're saying I'm not foreseeing something. I'm going to take us back to our Grange Hill days when we were at the BBC Centre. And we used to sneak into the Top of the Pops all the time. And if you ever go back to the 1980s, Lee knows. And you'll see Spandau Ballet and you'll see somebody in a green uniform right next door to them, you know. And this was the most bizarre thing, and my claim to fame really was that one afternoon we were in the canteen, and I was there sitting there eating my lunch and so on, and Billy No Mates as usual sitting by myself, and these two guys come over to me and they say, "Do you mind if we can we have lunch? We, you know, sit with your table." I said, "Absolutely, no problem at all, buddy." They sit down. And we start talking, and he goes, "You're the guy for Grange Hill, aren't you?" And I goes, "Yeah." He goes, "Oh, so they're filming that here today?" I goes, "Yeah." I said, "So what are you here for?" And he goes, "Oh, we're debuting our single today on Top of the Pops." And I'm like, "Oh, really?" I said, he goes, "Yeah." He said, "They put us up in some crummy little bed and breakfast up on Shepherd's Bush Green." I thought, "All right." And I said, "So," he goes, right. And he goes, "Can I have your autograph?" And I said, of course I can. Okay, yeah, there you go. Like, give me a napkin. And I said, okay. "What's your name, buddy?" He goes, "George." So I say, "Right, to George, best wishes, Mark Baxter, Dwayne Granger, thank you so much." And I goes, "Anyway, what's the name of this single you're putting out?" He goes, "It's called Wham Rap." It was George Michael.
George Michael asked me for my autograph.
Right? Wow. You know, that's the kind of thing that happens to you once in your lifetime. And so the rest is, I don't know whatever happened to them two, by the way, something, I don't know. But the one thing I will say to people out there, and going back to Alison and Lee's points, which were really good, was that this year, if anything comes out, you know, if we've learned anything, is that old saying that people tell you all the time, that you only live once. Well, actually, that's not true. The fact is you only die once and you live every day. So please do it.
Oh, Mark.
Yes, absolutely, Mark.
That's lovely. Oh, if I was allowed and we weren't on a remote screen, I'd bloody hug you for that.
Thank you.
From a girl who sat on a sofa religiously watching you guys and learned so much from you, just a massive heartfelt thank you for giving up your time to talk to me. You've really have been beyond a pleasure. You've exceeded all my wildest dreams. And I've now got to go and phone Keith Lemon and Ben Shepherd to tell them what you're like in real life, because they made me promise. So the legend lives on.
Really good.
Happy Christmas, everyone.
Yeah, happy Christmas, everybody.
Happy Christmas to you guys, and a really healthy, very healthy and happy new year to you all. And I hope it's not the last time that we speak. God bless you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kate.
My huge thanks again to the cast of Grange Hill. Wasn't that great? Thank you so much for joining us. As always, this show is produced by me, Kate Thornton, alongside Michael Bartonowicz for Yahoo UK, with Callum Goddard-Mucklow co-producing and editing for us today. We'll be back with you with another show for next week. Until then, thank you so much for listening. And remember, over this festive period, wash your hands, stay safe, and do as we always do, and try to drink responsibly. Oh, and Merry Christmas.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The championship season is over, and what a season it was.
But the best is yet to come. It's the playoffs.
Who will make it to the Premier League?
And who will be left heartbroken at Wembley?
Stay across it all with the second tier.
We're bringing you episodes after every leg.
And in between, we're revisiting the greatest moments in playoff history.
It's real conversation with two real championship obsessives.
So you can be in the know about everything happening in the playoffs.
And share all your new knowledge in the pub with your mates.
So come join us.
We're your one-stop shop for the playoffs.
Search second tier in your podcast app
and hit subscribe.